I think one thing about hunter-gatherer way of life, and the Aka certainly included here, is their flexibility. I mean, that once you get to be farming and pastoral societies where you have this deference and respect of elders and men, that's where you get the very strict ideas in terms of what it's like to be a man and what it's like to be a woman. That's why the men don't hold the babies, because that's not what guys do.
You're listening to the Untaming Podcast.
Rewild the Child.
Here is your host, Emily Giles.
Hi, I'm Emily. Welcome back to the Untaming Podcast. Today it is the first quarter of the Worm Moon here in the Southern Hemisphere. I don't think I mentioned in my last interview with biological dentist Diana Cortez, a book by Dr. Stephen Lin. It's called The Dental Diet, The Surprising Link Between Your Teeth, Real Food, and Life-Changing Natural Health. I found that to be a really excellent book. If you have read Weston Price's Nutrition and Physical Degeneration, or are at least familiar with Weston Price's work, then I feel like Stephen Lin's book, and he also has an informative Instagram account, are like a modern continuation of Weston Price. So definitely check him out if you enjoyed the last interview with Diana, or if you're interested in maintaining or improving the health of your family. In the next episode, I interview Dr. Oscar Serilac. I thoroughly enjoyed talking to him, so much so that I ended up switching around the order I'd set for the episodes to be released, simply so I could release it to you sooner than intended. So make sure you tune in for that one. But today we have our guest host, Mary Fransell, back again, this time interviewing Dr. Barry Hewlett. It was his book, Hunter-Gatherer Childhoods, that I was reading at the time I first began producing this podcast.
Hello, everyone. Welcome again to the Untaming Podcast. This is your occasional guest host, Mary Fransell, IBCLC. I have a private lactation practice in Washington State in the U.S., and I also write the blog, What Do Babies Need? At www.whatdobabiesneed.com. And I am just thrilled today to introduce our special guest. Dr. Barry S. Hewlett earned his PhD from the University of California at Santa Barbara and is currently professor of anthropology at Washington State University, Vancouver, Washington, in the United States. He's best known for his study of the Aka Pygmy people of Central Africa. He's worked with his wife, Dr. Bonnie Hewlett, who concentrates her study on Aka women and health issues. His publications include 7 books and over 100 book chapters and journal articles. Dr. Hewlett's books include Hunter-Gatherer Childhoods, Evolutionary, Developmental, and Cultural Perspectives, and Father-Child Relations, Cultural and Biocultural Contexts. His research interests currently include the cultural influence on infant development, the cultural context of various tropical diseases, the impact of new African tropical forest parks and reserves on the local people, cultural transmission, and biocultural evolution. Dr. Hewlett's interests in infectious diseases include local cultural models of disease, incorporating anthropological approaches to disease control efforts, and emerging diseases, including Ebola. Last night, he got 7 or 8 hours of sleep, and for breakfast, he had eggs, cereal, and some leftover tuna. Welcome, Dr. Hewlett. Thank you so much for joining me.
What a pleasure to be with you.
Wonderful. So can you first, by telling our audience a little bit about how you first became interested in anthropology? This is something I pretty much ask everyone because I think it's interesting to find out how people got involved in this field.
Well, it's sort of, I feel like I have anthropology genes. I had no idea what anthropology was when I was growing up. And I, you know, like in fifth grade and stuff, whenever we were given assignments to do social study assignments to do different countries of the world or something, that I just loved it. And I just love different understanding and different parts of the world, different cultures of the world. And then when I went to community college, I took an anthropology course and I thought, wow, what is this? You know, it was totally new. And it was actually biological anthropology. But from there, it was really, I just loved it. And I just followed my love of the discipline. But I have always been interested in peoples and cultures of the world. And so, and I just followed, you know, my love and things worked out.
That's wonderful. I many times wish I had discovered anthropology sooner. I might have taken a different path, but I'm taking my studies from learning about it now from more reputable people in the field. So I appreciate your being here with us. Could you start by telling us a little bit about what you learned from the Akka people during your field work? In particular, why did you choose to study the role of Akka fathers?
Why don't I start with the second question first?
Sure.
That why study Akka fathers? The first thing is that I was working at Head Start, a preschool program in Northern California. And that in my work in Head Start, there weren't very many fathers around. Most of the time was mom and their kids and such, but there was very little focus or interest in fathers. And then when I finished my bachelor's degree, I took a trip to Europe and ended up in Africa. And then I took a few more trips to Africa, and I was just basically sort of like a world traveler type person, hitchhiking across Europe, hitchhiking across the Sahara Desert. And that, you know, I ended up in Central Africa, and there are very few people at the time who were actually conducting research. And so one of the individuals I found was, his name was Luca Cavalli-Sforza at Stanford University. And one of his colleagues was a psychiatrist named Herb Lederman, who had been in the field. And he said, you know, you've been down there and you've spent some time with the Akka. And, you know, one thing I noticed is that the fathers are very involved. And he was absolutely right. But from his sort of, you know, cue and my interest, you know, from what my experiences in Head Start, that I wrote a proposal and ended up, you know, conducting the study of fathers. I mean, I did not have my kids at the time, so it was started before I had kids.
And can you tell us a little bit more about the role of Akka fathers in the lives of their children? And I know that they're one of the most involved cultures out there. And what are some of the reasons why they are so involved in the care of their children? And how do they care for their children?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right. The Akka have been voted by this one agency, this fatherhood agency in UK, as being the best fathers in the world. But the idea of the best fathers in the world, and the reason they were voted the best fathers in the world, is because part of the research that I did is I actually quantified the amount of time that fathers are actually with their babies. And the Akka came out on top in terms of the amount of time. They're basically within an arm's reach of their babies around 50% of a 24-hour period. So that number one is that they're very physically very close. They're holding their babies frequently. But, you know, their roles are multidimensional. They're holding, they will offer their breast to their infant on occasion to soothe. Fathers are very, very involved in terms of transmitting culture. I mean, they're very, since they're there quite frequently, they are the ones who obviously are providing food on a regular basis along with the rest of the family. And, you know, they're also, you know, very involved in terms of protection of the family. You know, that it's very different than in the United States, for instance, where, you know, the protection side and the education side are really taken over by different institutions. And so that the roles of fathers are very multidimensional. We tend to focus on right now, we have this value about the amount of time, and we see that as particularly important. But obviously fathers do many things. And that part seems to be missed, I think. I mean, that fathers do multiple things. It's not only, you know, it's not only touching and holding, but fathers do many, many things. And among the Aka, that's definitely the case. In terms of learning from the Aka, I think you asked that question, or?
Yeah, just some interesting things that might be shared with our listeners.
I mean, one thing that is, I mean, important to me, I mean, is to understand the context sort of this high father involvement, that one is the Aka are fiercely egalitarian. That in terms of gender egalitarianism, in terms of male, female, in terms of political egalitarianism, in terms of generally, you know, ranking of different males, but it's also a relative age egalitarianism, which means that there's fairly equal in terms of, you know, the young and the old, in terms of that there's no sort of, you know, I have gray, my whole head is all gray, and there's no sort of respect and deference towards people who are older, okay? That's relatively equal. And sort of like, it really became evident with me. I was out net hunting. The Aka net hunters were men, women, and children all go out net hunting together. You know, in the whole group, the group is around 25, 35 people. Everybody goes out and we hunt for these different dike ears, and some of them are very large. And one time that I captured a large dike ear, 150-pound one, in the net. And I jumped on it, and a whole bunch of other people came and actually helped me kill the animal in the net. But for me, I was so excited about, you know, capturing this particular dike here in the net. And we went back to camp, and I was sort of really pumped about doing this. I mean, I had captured lots of other smaller dike here before this, but this one was huge. And I thought people may say things. But what people said was that, you know, that's a baby one. That's a really tiny one. I thought, what is this? You know, what? And they said, no, that's just a, and it's really pretty scrawny, you know. And one is it, I mean, reminded me on a regular basis in Aka camps, what they were trying to do is control my boastfulness. They were trying to make me, you know, so, you know, I'm no better than anybody else. But at the same time, what it made me realize is that in the Aka camp, on an almost daily basis, children and adults are reminded that you're no better than anybody else. But it made me think is that in the U.S., that on a daily basis, on a regular basis, you're reminded every single day somebody's better than or worse than you. Even in preschool, kids get little smiley faces or something, you know, that some kids are better than others, you know, and then you have all this stuff in terms of your boss. You have your boss and you have all this stratification, and that it's really profoundly different. Okay. That on a daily basis, we're reminded of that stratification. And so it's not surprising then that, you know, in the US, we always have these issues about, you know, self-worth and self, you know, that whether or not, you know, that how good are we, you know, in terms of, you know, that self-esteem, is questioned on a daily basis, because you have, you know, and you're always trying to be deferent to those people who have more, you know, your teacher, your boss, or whatever. And so that it really reminds you, I mean, that particular experience, even though I had lived it for many years already, and I you know, talk about the ACA as egalitarian, but that sort of personal experience of capturing this big daiquiri made me reflect a little bit on my own culture and really brought it home that on a daily basis that we are ranked. And so that that's one thing, that in terms of understanding the context of ACA life. Mm-hmm. Another is respecting autonomy. And these things sort of go together, is that it's so central for the ACA to respect the desires of other individuals, be they young or be they old. And so that, you know, among the ACA, the young kids, a one-year-old will pick up a big machete or pick up, you know, and nobody sort of interferes, that you sort of have this tolerance in terms of what particular other people want to do. Some people leave camp every day and go visiting. Some people don't want to hunt on a particular day. And sort of you sort of respect that individual, his or her. Sometimes, generally speaking, it's the men who carry the nets, for instance. And some days a woman will get up and she says, I'm going to carry the net today. And so that you respect that, you know, that's, and one of the big things about hunter-gatherer life is this flexibility. And so that is in part in terms of understanding father's roles, in terms of it's no issue of fathers to pick up and hold infants to offer the breast or whatever, okay? Because you have this sort of flexibility and respect of autonomy of individuals. So you have this extreme tolerance. And the last thing is sharing. I mean, all these things sort of fit together, that you can't have somebody boasting about themselves, because if they think they're better than others, then they think they should get more food than others. And so, and that's also linked to this respect for autonomy in terms of everybody is relatively equal. But the thing about the sharing is that's distinct about the hunter-gatherers is that that the food is shared with everybody else in camp. The camp is like 25, 35 people. And so we're used to sharing like within the family, within maybe even within your extended family. But the thing is that when the ACA, when they hunt, about 80% of what they bring into the camp is given to other people in the camp outside of their nuclear family. So that big daiquiri that I captured was shared with everybody. It wasn't, you know, I didn't keep it or store it just for the families that I was staying with. And so that this, all these things are sort of linked, and it's very important to understand, I think, that context in terms of understanding all the other things about infant care, about parenting, and all of, you know, so like ACA fathers are very, very involved, okay, with their babies. But the ACA, the fathers are just one of many, okay? And, you know, that some of you probably have heard about the term allo-maternal care, people who help care besides mother. Well, fathers are just one of many, okay? And so that, you know, fathers are just one of many different caregivers that you find in hunter-gatherer camps. And so if you can understand that sharing of food with every other household within the camp, you get a better understanding of how you share caregiving of your children with everybody else in that camp. Okay, so that's, you know, like you have allomaternal nursing, where you have women other than mother will nurse the baby. This occurs mostly in early infancy, because in late infancy and later on, you do have attachment more so to mother. She's obviously not the sole caregiver whatsoever, but kids do become a little bit more attached. And you have this sort of greater feeding by mother in late infancy by comparison to early infancy. Anyway, so you have this allomaternal care by many others. And anyway, I'm sorry.
Oh, well, that's wonderful. Absolutely. And I recall you talking about how the infant generally is carried on the hunt by the mother, but I imagine that's primarily for just practical reasons, because then she can just nurse the baby when and the baby's right there. Whereas in camp, the baby is, you know, she can go over and nurse the baby when she wants, but the you know, other people in the camp are not as busy with their own tasks on the hunt. Would that be fair?
Right. I mean, the thing is that on the net hunt, you have to think about all the nets are set up in like a circle or semicircle about half the size of a football field. So other people are not very close. So that, but on the net hunt, fathers do regularly carry when they're moving from setting up the nets. So that, so it's not unusual for fathers to do, they do much more in the camp when they're, but they do help out quite a bit on the net hunt.
Absolutely. So how does this father involvement among the Aka compare with other foragers and or other hunter-gatherer communities? And can you give some examples of some other situations we might, you know, other father, more paternalistic societies or so on that might be a contrast to the Aka?
Well, I mean, first of all, that hunter-gatherers provide more direct care to infants and young children by comparison to any other subsistence pattern. So that hunter-gatherers in general do more than farmers or pastoralists or generally in especially in urban industrial cultures. So that hunter-gatherers tend to do more overall. But the Aka are particularly high by comparison to other hunter-gatherers, in part because of this, their particular subsistence strategy, which is the net hunt. I mean, that everybody goes net hunting. So, you know, women and men are together, and that there are other, you know, that there's also bow and arrow hunting and crossbow hunting, in which husband and wife go out together. So husband and wife among the Aka do relatively more by comparison to other hunter-gatherer groups, and so that the fathers are available more so by comparison to other hunter-gatherer groups.
So you might have other cultures where the men go out and they might you know, leave maybe the children and the women, grandmothers and so on back in camp doing other subsistence activities. And so there just isn't as much connection and as much time together. Is that fair?
Exactly. So that, you know, women go out gathering, men go out hunting. And so that they're not, men are not around as often. But I mean, that, you know, I mean, like I said, there are lots of things that men and women do together in terms, and you know, especially with gathering, that men are involved in some gathering, lots of gathering activities, actually. So it's mostly when men go out to go after the larger game animals that women may not. But I do want to point out that there are many cultures and more, many hunter-gatherer cultures where you have women hunters. And so that the Aka, you know, you have many in Central Africa, you have many other net hunting groups. The Aka are just one. And so that you have many other net hunting groups in which women are regular participants. And then you have other places in the world where women are spear hunters or women are archers. So that And in those cultures, fathers tend to do more as well.
Absolutely. Are there some other factors as well? I'm sure there are that paternalistic attitudes that come into play as well, or is it really mostly just a practical need to take care for the children?
Well, I mean, it may be helpful maybe to compare a little bit between the Aka, the hunter-gatherer group, and their neighboring farmers, the Ngandu. Mm-hmm. The neighboring farmer Ngandu men do nothing with babies. Okay. Mm-hmm. Among the Ngandu, they are patrilineal, patrilocal, and you are supposed to show deference and respect to elders, and you're supposed to show deference and respect, especially to male elders. And so that you have that more patriarchal sort of situation. And so fathers there do not do very much at all. They like to have babies, and they tend to have multiple wives. The Aka are much more likely to be monogamous, but some Aka men have more than one wife. And that would be an example where when you start to get a type of social organization, like you mentioned, in terms of patrilineal, patrilocal, farming or pastoral societies, that's where male care tends to, direct care tends to decline.
Absolutely. So, I mean, obviously there's a wide variety among groups, pastoralists, hunter-gatherers, et cetera. But in general, how does father involvement in these more traditional cultures contrast with fathers in many, Western societies, what we like to call weird societies, Western, educated, industrial, I can't remember the other things that go along with that acronym.
Rich but and democratic.
Absolutely, yeah. So if you could just talk a little bit about some of those reasons, and some of those differences and possible reasons for those.
Well, I mean that it's just profoundly different. I mean that you can start to make some comparisons in terms of the amount of time fathers spend with kids. With babies or whatever. But if you just think about co-sleeping, just one dimension, I mean, that among the Aka, that in terms of you have your daytime and then you have nighttime, and then kids are co-sleeping with their parents, all the time up until generally pretty much up until adolescence. So they're not only co-sleeping, there's a lot of interest and concern about co-sleeping these days. And there's, that we talk about co-sleeping, but generally the topic is limited to infants, and everybody does, there's more and more people who are sort of interested in co-sleeping in infancy or early childhood, but you never hear about co-sleeping at 7, 8, 9, 10. And so that, often I ask my students, and generally they're okay with co-sleeping with babies. But then I ask them, what about a seven-year-old? How would you feel about co-sleeping with your seven-year-old? And no way, And so, this is just one area where life is profoundly different. And obviously there's lots of things that happen, in terms of communication, in terms of education, in terms of all different aspects of life that happen at night. And so that in terms of, comparisons between weird and, I actually don't like that particular term because that everybody is worthy of research, and we tend to say, well, that the focus is on weird. Yes, it is much of the psychological research has been on weird, but everybody sort of, to me, is sort of worthy of, I mean, of research. And so that I just sort of have some issues with that.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I mean, you're not going to find any disagreement with me. I mean, I administer a group called Biologically Normal Infant and Toddler Sleep on Facebook. And so we have a large group of people who do co-sleep bed share for many, many years. And it is a normal thing. It's just not very common in Western cultures. So absolutely.
One thing I really do want to point out, though, I mean, that, you know, that I have been fortunate enough in my life to live for years and years among the Akka and the Chabu, other hunter-gatherer groups. And so I've been very, very lucky. And I feel like I've learned some lessons about, you know, life, about my own children. I have seven kids. And so that I've learned some things about life for myself. And I, you know, I can talk about lessons learned from the hunter-gatherers, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's better. I mean that say, take the fathers, for instance, that for a long time that there used to be these advertisements on for milk, that milk is, you know, better for you. It's milk is good for you. And that the thing is that obviously for many people in the world, milk, if you're lactose intolerant, is not good for everybody. It causes all kinds of problems. And the same thing about fathers. I mean, in terms of father involvement, not every father can be as involved like with the Akka. So that, you know, high involvement may not be best for everybody. You know, that, I mean, we, there, you know, been, what kids, for me, in terms of what kids need is love, and they, in terms of sensitive caregiving. And that many, but high father involvement, you know, like the Ngandu fathers I was describing a minute ago, you know what, their kids grew up to be fine. Mm-hmm. You know,
I really love the point you made about alloparenting, about it doesn't have to just be the father, you know, as long as the kids are cared for by many people, they do great.
Yeah, sensitive caregivers. I mean that, you know, that it's really sort of that you're responsive to listening to the kids. And that, I mean, that gets back to a big, one sort of difference that has been identified by a Western developmental psychologists is that that fathers are known for being their physical rough and tumble playmates in the US, in Europe, in Australia, that in literally hundreds of studies have documented that fathers are, by comparison to mothers, more physical rough and tumble playmates with their kids. And this is the way that fathers demonstrate their love and interest in their babies and young children. And so one of the hypotheses that I tested in the field with the Akka was this idea that physical rough and tumble play was a way by which infants become attached to fathers. And it didn't exist. And so that you did not have this physical rough and tumble play difference between mothers and fathers among the Akka. And the way that, you know, that infants become attached to their fathers is through the regular care. I mean, that the fathers did not have to stimulate or, you know, their infants. They're sleeping with their infants. They are holding their infants. They're near their infants. And so that they can wait for, you know, the communication to come from the infant. They, you know, that, and so that they did not need this sort of physical rough and tumble play to demonstrate their care. So that's not a universal way in terms that infants become attached to fathers. And so that was, one difference there between you know, the West and the Aka fathers.
It's interesting. It's almost like in the West, there's so little physical contact sometimes between fathers, they without the co-sleeping and the, you know, care, you know, daily care, that that's kind of, in a way, what substitutes for it is that physical contact in some ways.
Right. And again, I mean, that one thing about the Aka camps, like I said, they're sharing with everybody in the camp, but the camp is very dense. You know, that it's very, people are living very close, where you put your arm out to your outside of your house and you can almost touch the house next to you. Okay. So that it's people all living, you know, not, you know, all close. It's not, it's the co-sleeping, obviously, within the family, but then you have all these other people that are living very, very close. And all these other people living very, very close, you know. No. So that means you get to know everybody very well. And so this sensitivity towards where people are at or how they're feeling, what's going on. But this other, the other thing is, though, you know, the recent thing that I've hypothesized is that this frequent touch and this frequent proximity decreases cortisol, which is your stress hormone, in terms of touch. And it also, we know that frequent touch also increases oxytocin. And so that, so it's a feedback mechanism, you know, sort of thing in terms of hunter-gatherer life is stressful. I mean, you know, some days are not as much food as other days, you know what I mean? And so that it is stressful. And my wife did a study of Aka adolescents, and the adolescents remembered around 15 different funeral ceremonies that they had gone to by age 15. Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, you have grief. And so people, because of high mortality levels. And so that hunter-gatherer life is stressful. So that one way to potentially reduce that is this touch and the physical proximity. And the other thing is that this amount of sharing, this oxytocin, also acts as a feedback in terms of helping and caring for others. So it's a, you know, it's a, again, to understand fathers and the nature of father-child, infant or father-child relations, you need to understand this physical proximity to many others, the egalitarianism, the respect for autonomy, the sharing. And so that's one reason why I have sort of problems sort of in the popular press about taking out one segment of hunter-gatherer life and sort of saying this is best for all, because it's ripped out of its context without understanding where it came from, how it evolved, and its particular context. And I think that's one reason why, I mean, particular groups, there's been, you know, I don't know if you know about attachment parenting group.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So, I mean, there's been, you know, I mean, there are many things I like about the kinds of things that they talk about. But the other thing is that the things they promote, you know, that it, you know, there have been articles written that are fairly critical of this approach because it puts so much burden on mothers. And you're totally out of a context of extensive allomaternal care, where you reach across outside of your house and there are 20 other people, you know, right there, you know. So, I mean, it's taken totally out of context, and that without understanding how much, you know, how much that really entails, you know, that in terms of, you know, doing some of these things about holding all the time and being physical, but there's lots of other people around.
Mm-hmm. That is such a good point. And, you know, I often talk to people about that, parents that I work with. I mean, my children are grown now, but, you know, the social media communities are wonderful in some ways, but they don't substitute for actual physical presence of other people. And, you know, really in Western culture, we do need to recreate that kind of village as much as possible. If we're going to be able to parent that way, we need to involve other people and get together in groups to share care, because parents need a break. It's not, you know, right to put it all on one person.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean that. I mean, the ACA, I mean, it just, there are so many other people, I mean, sort of close by. And the thing, another thing is that, you know, we mentioned the earlier, I think we mentioned the homosexual, I don't know if we were talking about the homosexuality before we were on or off.
No, just a little bit beforehand. Yeah.
Beforehand. Yeah. But anyway, my wife and I did study sexual behavior. And one of the results of the study was we found that the Yaka were having sex 3 to 4 times a night. And you know, you say that, you know, and that's talking about, you know, 40-year-olds, 50-year-olds. I mean, it's not just your 19 or 20-year-olds who are doing this. And that the thing is that, you know, you tell that to folks in the West and they think, well, you know, they're just into pleasure. And, you know, but what it is that they're having frequent sex to grow a fetus. They love kids. They love kids. And that's a major goal in your life, is to have kids and actually to have many. And so that, you know, which is, you know, that so in the West, we often also tend to think about, we love kids, but at times they're a burden. You know, we need a date night, or we need, you know, time to get away, you know, and we do need time to get away. But the thing is that the idea of kids being a burden is would be totally opposite in terms of what the ACA would think of, is that they're, you know, like I said, they're having, you have your work of the day, your net hunting, and then you have your work of the night, and that's sex. And your work of the night at sex, I mean, obviously they're enjoying it, but the thing is that the reason behind it is to have to grow a fetus, okay? That once is not enough. You have to grow the fetus. And so that you have to have, you know, regular, you know, frequent sex. But that I just mention that because of the high desire and love of children. But the but on the other hand, though, it's not like our ideas of childhood in the West. Ideas of childhood in the West is that childhood is a time of play and adventure and learning. Okay, and so we are expected to provide all of this sort of time for kids to play and to, you know, and for education. But the thing is, among the ACA, I mean, that kids are also nurturers. They're the ones they also help take care of other kids. Like I've been, you know, that it's not, you know, that, you know, that it's not just the adults. And so that you have, especially as you get older, both boys and girls, you know, help to take care of. And they, like I said, they love kids. So they're often walking up to somebody else asking if they could hold the baby. Okay. It's not, you know, sometimes it gets passed around. If it's a fussy baby, you know, maybe the baby gets passed around to 5 people or something. But very often that kids will walk up to somebody else and just want to hold the baby. So that.
Well, that's so interesting. That focus on babies. And obviously, as you said, there's a high mortality rate if children are going to so many funerals. So they have to really, in many cases, focus on more and more children for survival reasons. And I think we talked a little bit ahead of time that may have something to do with the fact that they don't know. There's really no concept of homosexuality in the ACA because they are so focused on sex for reproduction. Is that fair to say?
Right. Why would you waste semen? I mean, from a guy's perspective, I mean, why waste semen, you know, in terms of with another guy, you know, that I have a friend, a colleague who conducted research in another part of Central Africa. He's an environmental anthropologist, and the fertility rates among this group was very low. And he was trying to understand why it was so low. And so he was collecting semen samples. And so to try to get an idea, and then he would take the semen samples to try to see, you know, how, what their numbers are like. And that, so, but the thing is, when the particular group of people brought the samples to him, they always had vaginal fluid, so that they were not going to waste their semen, you know, that they can bring it. They would bring it to the researcher, but they were not going to waste it, you know. So
that's so interesting. And I know that there are other, you know, other traditional cultures that do have, you know, different gender fluidity. And in general, that's where people who have are not interested in necessarily in sex for reproduction will invest in perhaps their siblings' children in order to promote their line. But it's a different focus that the Aka have. So
And you don't have And so I mean that I think one thing about hunter-gatherer way of life, and the Aka certainly included here, it in terms of is their flexibility. I mean, that once you get to be farming and pastoral societies where you have this deference and respect of elders and men, that's where you get the very strict ideas in terms of what it's like to be a man and what it's like to be a woman. That's why the men don't hold the babies, because that's not what guys do. And so that, that's where you, but in hunter-gatherers, I mean, what it's for me, that one of the most important things is flexibility, in terms of flexibility, in terms of gender roles, flexibility in terms of subsistence activities. You know, the Aka are moving their camps 8 times a year. And so they're moving their camps. Somebody moves into a camp every day. A lot of my students say, well, you know, how difficult is it to work in an Aka camp? Well, the thing is that there are changes in an Aka camp every day. Somebody is leaving, and like me, I'm coming in. So it's like a very flexible thing, and you don't need to get permission from anybody. But when I go to live in the village with the farming group, with the Ngandu, I need to go see the chief. I need to talk to everybody to get permission to come and live there. And but among the Aka, that the way of life is, you know, that what's so important is this flexibility. I mean, there are gender roles, okay? I mean, it's not that gender roles don't exist. They exist. But the thing is that they are incredibly flexible.
That's just fascinating. And I'm sure you're familiar with the work of Lee Gettler and, and his studies of testosterone in, you know, men per more involved fathers. And I think it would, I assume there's not been this kind of testing done on the two groups you've been talking about, but it would be really interesting to see what, you know, because obviously Aka men are both very involved, but they also are very sexually active. So that would not, you know, necessarily indicate a low testosterone level, but it would be fascinating to
know. Oh, yeah. I mean, I know Lee very well. And that, I mean, and the thing is that they have conducted, you know, that in terms of testosterone and that after birth, I mean, testosterone levels do go down among the hunting gathering group. So I don't know of any studies that Lee's done with oxytocin, but I do know that with childbirth and such, with a group very similar to the Aka, that they're after childbirth, that their levels do go down a bit.
It's obviously, as you said, there are so many different factors, you know, not just one hormone, there's many hormones that are involved and many other factors that are involved. So that's just amazing. So, you know, we talked a lot about the alloparenting that goes on among hunter-gatherers. And you said in, you know, the Ngandu that, you know, the farming communities, there's very little father involvement, but in the Aka, many. So, I mean, what kinds of people are involved? Because I know that children are not necessarily as involved, older siblings, that is, are not necessarily as involved in certain cultures. And but there are there grandparents? Is it, you know, aunts and uncles, just people in the community? What do you find among the Akka as opposed to perhaps the Ngandu in terms of who cares for infants?
Well, I mean that you're absolutely right. Among the farming group, you know, that they don't live in such dense context, and they live in mud huts, mud houses, thatched houses. And so that the secondary caregivers among the farming group tends to be the older sibling. And so that among the Akka, obviously the fathers are very important, but they have care that so that since fathers are much more involved, you have less care from older siblings. You do have it. It's not like it doesn't exist, but by comparison to farmers, for instance, that it's not as great. The other thing is, though, that among the farmers, that often the parents will say, go take care of your, you know, baby brother or sister, or to watch them or something. And the one thing about the Akka that's a bit different is the frequency in which they refuse the commands or the request of their parents. So that, you know, that you have this respect of autonomy, you know, so that the parents do make requests. Can you go get some firewood? Can you go get some water, collect some water? And the kids, sometimes they just sit there. They don't do anything. And eventually the parent gets up and does it himself or herself. And so, you know, that so that's part of the thing in terms of the differences, in terms of why there may not be as much in terms of sibling care among the hunter-gatherers. I mean, there's, you know, that they don't have the responsibility to provide until they get married.
And so, in the Ngandu, it's probably a little more strict. I mean, is there punishment if the children disobey?
Right. Yes, absolutely. I mean, that's where you have, we haven't talked at all about discipline. Mm-hmm. I mean, among the Ngandu, corporal punishment is, you know, the hitting kids is like, you know, is relatively common. And that's sort of expected if you don't listen to your elders, that you will be hit. Among the Akka have told me, many people have told me that if a parent hits a child, that's a cause for the divorce. And so that it's much different. It's not, but parents, sometimes they will threaten with hitting, but if you do hit, but at the same time, again, I had a talk with some Akka parents once, and I said, what do you think about the Ngandu parents? You know, the way they socialize their kids. And they say they're horrible. They're absolutely horrible. They hit their kids. but then they said, you know what? But those kids, they listen to their parents. So they sort of understand the sort of trade-offs of so that they, but for them, the Akka are very nonviolent, non-aggressive. And so that also is sort of, you know, part of the reason why fathers tend to do more. They do not, among the Ngandu, for instance, the farmers, the fathers there see their role as protectors of the family. And which is somewhat true. They have to protect, they have plots. They live in their place. You know, they're sedentary. So that they actually have to protect their farms and their fields from the Akka. Because the Akka will raid their fields.
Absolutely. So can we talk a little bit about how when children get older, how they are involved in the contributing to the community, you know, either subsistence activities, childcare, gathering food, other like chores we might think about? How does that vary between, say, the Akka and the Ngandu in terms of children's roles in the community as they get older?
Well, it's, you know, they're contributing very early. Okay. I mean, the Akka, I mean, are contributing very early. I mean, they're on the net hunt. they play a role on the net hunt. They're chasing the animals. And so, I mean, that, so it's not like they're not contributing, that, and it increases obviously as they get older in terms of the amount of food they're providing, and what they will do. What, you know, that, and then adolescence is sort of a shifting time. And one thing about adolescence is, I mean, I think worth mentioning is you don't have sort of like the identity crisis that we have like in the West, because everybody knows who you are. Okay. There's no, none of this sort of acting out and other kinds of behaviors where you, you know, you change yourself, you change your clothes, you, they're definitely into styles. I mean, the adolescents, they cut their hair in particular ways. So, you know, they'll have particular scarifications, definitely into looking nice. But the thing is that in the West, we have this idea of, you know, who are you and what are you going to be and what's life going to be, you know, in terms of adolescence, in terms of Erickson's work, and that, but you tend not to have that with the Aka, because everybody knows who you are. You can't, you know, you can't recreate yourself, you know, by going to a different school or going to a different place or, and so anyway, so, so adolescence is a really interesting time, I think, it's among the hunter-gatherers. I mean, the hunter-gatherer, I mean, the adolescents are also the energizers, I think, of the culture, because that, you know, they're in very much into the mating game, but they also, in terms of dancing and singing, they, the dancing and singing happens on a couple times a week, and it almost always starts with the adolescents. They will start to be playing the drums or playing particular instruments, and they get things going, and eventually the parents come in and the others come in and the whole camp starts dancing. But for me, like, the adolescents are the energizers of the group. Among the Ngandu, it's a little bit different. I don't know them as well, frankly. But it seems like that the adolescents are still sort of under the thing in terms of deference and respect of elders, that, you know, it gets more strict as you get older in terms of expectations of what you should or should not be doing.
Absolutely. That's amazing. and I assume that adolescence is actually perhaps a little younger than we might think of. Do they start being more, you know, I don't know, do these things happen a little bit younger than we would think of in Western culture, or is it about the same time around, you know, 12, 13?
Well, I mean, you have, menstruation is later. Mm-hmm. And so that, we're talking 14, 15. Okay. And that, so that all the other secondary characteristics, I mean, are happening, about, you know, about 13, 14. And there is a, generally after menstruation, there's a 2-year period of subfertility. And so that it's very difficult to get pregnant during that 2-year period after menses start. And so there's sexual activity, but there's no sort of consequences of that sexual activity in terms of having, having babies. I mean, but babies are what people want anyway, but that, we haven't talked about divorce at all. Divorce is not that unusual. And the thing is that most of the divorces occur early in life. And so that, but after a child is born, then the marriages tend to last a good amount of time.
It's almost like that's a practice time for learning about sexuality and marriage and childcare and all of that.
Right. Yep. Nope. They exactly without the, without, you know, without getting pregnant. Yep.
So Another question is, you know, we have a lot of attachment parents, as you've mentioned, in Western societies, often kind of idealize some hunter-gatherer cultures as natural, biologically normal, or not just hunter-gatherer, but, you know, more traditional cultures. But there's, you know, as you said, it's a whole context, and there's not just, you know, all the great things that, right, you know, co-sleeping and so on. What are some of the other things that maybe are not so desirable in these cultures that, you know, you said that it's very stressful in many cases because of the threat of death and disease. So can you talk about some of the other things that are a little more stressful that we might not think about when we think about these more traditional cultures?
Well, I mean, I think you mentioned them right there. I mean, that, you know, that infectious and parasitic diseases are common, and that's the primary cause of death among children. The other thing is that among the Aka, a woman will on average have around 6 live births, and that during her lifetime, with those 6 live births, that around 50% of them will die before reaching their 15th birthday. So that in the U.S. and the West, we often say that a parent should never have to see the loss of one of their children. This is a very different situation, where that every parent is, on average, losing half of their children before they reach reproductive age. And so that infant mortality, they lose around 20% infant mortality. So that's, you know, 1 out of 5 don't make it to their first birthday. So that, you know, that it's way different. Food, I've been talking about the sharing, and, you know, that they are, you know, the sharing is like, it's on a daily basis. It's with everybody else, you know. It's, you know, it's profound. But the thing is, there are times of shortage. And so that there are times when there's not enough around. There are times where things are difficult, very difficult. So that, you know, there are other hunting gathering cultures. I mean, infanticide is very, very, very rare. Aka do not practice infanticide at all. Most hunter-gatherers do not, but in a few, they do. Among the Aché in South America. But, you know, and life is just, you know, as you know, I think it's on a daily basis. I mean, it's incredibly, like I said, I've been incredibly fortunate to live and understand, you know, on the ground what it's like to live in an egalitarian culture, to know what that really means. But on the other hand, I always come back here. I always come back.
Right.
and if it was amazing, I mean, there are certain things that are absolutely amazing. I've learned so much. But I come back, you know, I can have a cold beer. You know, and, but anyway, I mean, it just, I mean, yep,
there's definitely advantages and disadvantages wherever you go, but yeah, I think that's important to point out for sure.
But I do think, you know, what you mentioned, I do think it's very important to remember, I mean, with this, with the rewilding idea and with the ancestral idea, I know of a number of people, colleagues, psychologists at Notre Dame, you know, that they're promoting, you know, that this ancestral way is best. Now, many parts of it I like, and many parts I think it's just fine for people to try out individually, but to promote it as best without understanding the full context is really problematic. I mean, you know, we need science. We need some science. Those things that are, you know, that they're promoting, you know, with these ideas. I mean, one of them is like, I know, like, for instance, Peter Gray, I don't know if you know Peter Gray with education and trying to promote a hunter-gatherer education.
I believe Emily has interviewed him on this podcast before. I think that's...
Yeah. And so, I mean,
have different perspectives for sure.
Yeah. And so, I mean, and Peter Gray is taking hunter-gatherers and he's saying we should do a hunter-gatherer education. But the thing is that, and so the thought is that everything should be learned through play and that, but the thing is that it, one has to understand sort of like the full context of, you know, that in terms of what's happening in, you know, in terms of their particular, the lives of the children. I mean, that it is happening with all this touch. It's happening with all these different people, you know, that the people who are around them know these kids intimately well. And so that they don't have, Peter Gray saying there's no teachers in the what in hunter-gatherer education. That's not true, because the parents are, my definition of a teacher is somebody who modifies their behavior to help another learn. A teacher is not somebody only in a classroom situation. So among the Aka, that the parents and others in the camp are always modifying their behaviors very subtly, very sensitively to the particular individual, often through touch, often with a high amount of tolerance, but they are teaching. You know, they'll move the hand. The parents actually give the machetes to the kids to use. And so that teaching is going on. Teaching exists, you know, so that there is some, you know, some thought about, you know, from the parents and others about sort of like what's going on. And so that for me, it's just understanding things in full context.
Absolutely. And I think this is a great lead-in because your recent research has actually focused on children's learning in hunter-gatherer cultures. So do you want to say any more about that?
Not much. I mean, that the thing is that the Aka are, you know, incredibly, the kids are incredibly bright. Learning is absolutely self-motivated, self-directed. That, I mean, that the kids are going out, they're moving. The thing is that in their camp of 25, 35 people, you have all these different models. You have all these different people to go watch and to learn from. And they all want to help. You know, everybody wants to help. Everybody wants to give. And so that you have all these other, anyway, so that what we have found is that one is that the kids know around 80 or 90% of the skills to make a living in the forest by age 10. And that much of this sort of learning, you know, it occurs, they do have some teaching, you know, they do have some teaching. You also have a lot of child-to-child teaching. It's not just adults. And that it tends to be people who are genetically related to the child. It's not necessarily just the mother and father. Like you mentioned earlier, it can be aunts and uncles and others. But they tend, the people who tend to be investing do, in terms of their learning, do tend to be a little bit more tend to be genetically related to the child. But what happens in adolescence as kids get older, they tend to pick people who they're attached to. That's where you get the best friends. I learned from my, you know, my best friend. And this is also where they will also turn to some people who know a little bit better than others, how to dance a little bit better than others, or how to sing better than others, or how to hunt better than others. They turn to them rather than the parents. And so
that is just fascinating. And I, you know, I think that's a great place to wrap it up. I really so much appreciate all the time you've given me. And it's just amazing to hear all of this wonderful information about fathers and others in the Aka and other cultures. So thank you so much, Dr. Hewlett, for joining me today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much. Let me know if you have any questions.
Absolutely. And of course, we'll put a link to your information in the show notes. So thank you again.
Thank you very much.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can join the discussions on our Facebook and Instagram pages. To hear more, subscribe for free on the podcast app on your smartphone. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and all of your favorite podcast platforms. If you would like to offer feedback or suggest a guest, email us at untaming.podcast@gmail.com.